This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan, and I'm an editor at Avon News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today is Merv Tahirolu. She is the Turkey Program Coordinator at the Project on Middle East Democracy in Washington, D.C. Merv, pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, we have a lot going on this week on the inside Turkey. And the first one I'd really like to actually ask you about is the protest going on at Boğaziçi University. Right now we're in, I believe, the fourth week of protests on it. And just a few days ago, even we had a report that 159 students were arrested alone and then followed by 104 the next day. And some of these students were frankly brutalized once they were in police custody. And the authorities don't really show any signs of giving up anytime soon. But how does this recent protest to you compare to some of the past major ones, such as like the Gezi Park protests in 2013?
I think this is a great question because to a lot of us, it reminds us of the Gezi protests. I mean, that was much bigger in scale, of course. It had, hundreds of thousands of people all across Turkey. It had spread from just Taksim Square in Istanbul into all of Turkish cities, and it went on for months. And this one is not quite that big in scale yet, but there are so many similarities. I think the most important one would be that just like the Gezi protests, which originally started with about 50 people holding a demonstration simply for one thing, which was to prevent the demolition of a park in this Taksim Square in Istanbul, but quickly turned into an anti-government protest against oppression and police brutality. So it devolved into something much bigger because of the government's response. We're seeing the same scenario play out now with the Boğaziçi protests. Originally, it started with a few students and faculty coming together to protest this decision by Erdogan, President Erdogan, to intervene into the university administration by appointing basically his own political crony as the rector of the university. Yeah. And it was originally just about that. But then it devolved into something new, particularly when the protesters decided to first it was because that the students who were taken into custody, there were reports that they were being mistreated, including strip searched, etc., with police raids at dawn into the students' houses and dormitories. So it wasn't like these people were picked up from the street where they were protesting. But then it became something about, it included a much bigger anti-government hate speech, the anti-LGBT phenomenon, because the students, as part of their protest, held this exhibition in which they had this one artwork, which the government then said, because the artwork included LGBT symbols, alongside Islamic symbols like the Kaaba, where Muslims pray, they immediately called that a perversion and started treating the protesters as this wholesale, group of perverted people, meaning that, non-compliant, gender orientation, and what everybody in the world would consider to be clear hate speech against LGBT community. It's completely homophobic statements, which grew the protests, and that grew the police violence against them, and that turned into currently what we're seeing is people all over Turkey again, not as big as the Gezi protests, but all over Turkey, all over multiple neighborhoods in Istanbul, continuing to protest the government's response to the protesters. So it's quickly becoming something much bigger than it is. I want to, if I haven't spoken too much, I want to also add one more important thing that I think is very similar to the Gezi protests at the time. A big tool for those protesters at the time in 2013 for the Gezi protesters to mobilize against the government was social media, Twitter, Facebook. These were the platforms where protesters shared information about what was going on, called on people to come and join the protests and mobilized on. And right now we're seeing that again happen through Twitter, but also Clubhouse, this new app that the protesters seem to have been using. I mean, I'm particularly very interested in the role that Clubhouse seems to be playing in terms of disseminating real information about events that are going on on the ground, in the same way that Twitter served that function when the Gezi protests were happening and mainstream media in Turkey were similarly just blocking out that content or only giving government propaganda.
There's a very interesting trend there that you mentioned, and it ties into both aspects, the focus on the LGBT element, but also on the social media one, because recently we had a lot of reaction from some what were interpreted to be homophobic tweets from Turkey's interior minister, and just today, Devlet Bahçeli, Erdogan's coalition partner, he had some of his tweets deleted by Twitter for a similar reason. And this is all taking place within the background of what some have called an increasingly intolerant environment for LGBT people inside Turkey, on top of a deterioration in the access they might have to social media and privacy. So what do you make of all of this together? Like, taken together, what does this say to you?
I mean, certainly homophobia has been a large part of the Turkish government, Turkish state, for it's certainly nothing new under Erdogan. But what we are seeing is this increasingly brazen public homophobia expressed by top Turkish officials, and the interior minister coming out and calling LGBT protesters a pervert is the epitome of that. I mean, you cannot have a country that calls itself a democratic country, which Turkey still does against all odds, coming out and making such a statement. Erdogan and his government always says that, you know, we might not like, we might, use some repressive tactics against citizens. We might be controlling our media and information. We might have some tight laws, but we are ultimately trying to be a tolerant, open, pluralistic society. This is the ultimate example that they have no tolerance towards anyone not conforming to their political and religious and just, you know, from an identity politics point of view, not towing their line. Anyone who's not conforming into what the Turkish presidency would like Turkish citizens to be. Of course, they're just not going to be that. I do think that Twitter's decision to label these tweets and to remove them is very, very important. Social media, all major social media companies have basically been under attack in Turkey for a couple months now, particularly with the passage of this, what we call social media law in Turkey. I know you've talked about it in previous interviews as well, where Turkish government is now forcing all major companies like Twitter, like Facebook, like YouTube to appoint representatives in Turkey who would be responsible for taking down content per requested, you know, as the Turkish government or courts request them. So basically, it's a law that forces social media companies to comply with Turkish government censorship. Twitter has been one of the few companies that has, you know, has decided to take a strong line against that, and is refusing to bow down to these efforts of Turkish government censorship against itself. And, none of these social media platforms have a good strategy yet, very clearly, on how to navigate freedom of expression versus hate speech versus speech that could incite violence. We've seen this very clearly just earlier this month in Washington, D.C. And as they scramble to create a response towards that, in the same way that Twitter was you know, intervened very early on in January when we saw the insurgency here in the capital by labeling, intervening against President Trump's own incitement and labeling it and ultimately kicking him off the platform. Now they're stepping up their game towards other authoritarian leaders and politicians as well. And they stopped being as relaxed about it. And going after Turkish Interior Minister in this way, I think is definitely the right way to try to combat further violence.
The U.S. element I would also like to go into, but we're going to, I just want to ask one question first before we leave right into that, actually. And it goes back again to the government's overall reaction to this protest, these set of protests at Boğaziçi. And it's just some of the images that are coming out. We saw videos of snipers on a rooftop at the university. They fired rubber bullets at students, used tear gas, and this is on top of the, you know, the wide vocabulary choices they've chosen to use when it comes to the terrorists, anarchists, perverts, etc. And what they're basically describing them as if there are some sort of like internal enemy that needs to be fought rather than students protesting against the government, just student protesting against policy to disagree with or for their university. What I want to ask is, like, why is it that you think that the Erdogan government feels so challenged by these demonstrations?
Is it that they really feel challenged by it? Because I feel like, you know, if the Turkish government truly did see these protests as a threat against it, the one thing it shouldn't do is to give people more reason to come out and join those protests. And that's exactly what it's doing with this. I mean, we're seeing this unfold everywhere in the world, including in Russia currently. But the problem is that, you know, the labeling internal dissent as if on any level as terrorists or plotters or you know, traitors to the republic, to the state, is the hallmark of any populist authoritarian leader. We see authoritarian, particularly populist leaders using this device to sort of divide society, to paint certain people who are opposing completely, policies or government positions, totally normal things that you would want your citizenry to be opposing or critiquing in a functioning, healthy democracy. Labeling that kind of dissent or any kind of dissent as terrorist, as enemies to the state, is to try to get the broader segments of the society to also see that dissent as something fundamentally bad for the health and prosperity of Turkey. Now, of course, that is not the case. They're using this device, but given how much the Turkish government controls the media and the information ecosystem in Turkey, I worry that this particular line might become convincing. Now, of course, in this particular context, when we look at, you know, the Boğaziçi University students, I don't think it's going to work in the same way that Erdogan's efforts to paint all the Gezi protesters back in 2013 as terrorists didn't work, because it was such the protesters were such a diverse group that represented leftists, rightists, Kurds, Turks, members of the LGBT community, social conservatives, all of them at the same time. So you can't paint all of those people just in one brush as one thing. I think they're encountering the same problem with Boğaziçi University. One way they're trying to demonize them is to say they're terrorists. Another way they're trying to demonize them is to say that these are elitist people in Turkey who represent, you know, the top 1%. It's, again, a very populist message. The top 1% of Turkish society. They're trying to draw this socioeconomic, you know, difference between the protesters and the rest of Turkey. That is not going to work, because Boğaziçi University is a public institution. I mean, it's
it's appointed rector if it wasn't.
Exactly. I mean, it's not really like the, it's not, it wouldn't be fair to compare it to some universities in the US that, you know, have similar kinds of criticism, like Harvard, Yale, or really expensive institutions that have a lot of legacy, where legacy plays a lot of role in who gets admitted. That's not at all the way the university system works in Turkey. Everybody goes through the exam and the top performing students make it to this university and become part of that university's culture. It's not a socioeconomic situation as they're trying to paint it. So I think, you know, given this knowledge about what the university represents and who these students are and how diverse really they are, and the bigger the protests grow, I think the government's message to paint them all as terrorists or elitists or this or that is just going to fail.
Like I mentioned before, I wanted to pull this into the U.S. also, because this week we also saw the U.S. government, the State Department to be specific, they released some statements to us on how they feel about the detention of some LGBT students by Turkish authorities. And we also got statements from the U.S. government on the imprisonment of Osman Kavala and Selahattin Demirtas, the HDP leader. And this seems pretty significant, since this follows almost 4 years of relative quiet from the, at least the Trump administration, when it came to Turkey's violation of human rights inside its own country. And I want to ask you, how important do you find it to be for the Biden administration to be so much more willing and less shy to speak about these issues?
It's really encouraging, I think, for all of us who want to see a more democratic and pro-human rights Turkey, and also for those of us who want to see ultimately a better Turkish-US relationship. As you mentioned, I mean, the Trump administration completely ignored Erdogan's power grabs and transgressions against democratic principles or principles of the rule of law. I would actually say that they didn't just ignore it, they encouraged it. I mean, Trump was the type of leader who respected other strongmen, and Erdogan is the ultimate strongman. So this was, you know, quite encouraging for strongmen leaders just like Erdogan everywhere across the globe. And already with the Biden administration only been around for a few weeks now in the White House for weeks now, we've seen multiple statements that relate to Turkey's democracy and human rights situation internally. I think that's very encouraging. But at the same time, it's not really enough. One good example is the phone call this week that happened between the National Security Advisor, Biden's National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, and I guess it's fair to call Ibrahim Kalın in Turkey his Turkish counterpart, given how close of a relationship Ibrahim Kalın has with Erdogan. He's officially, I think, the spokesperson, but it's a pretty similar role. And the White House's readout of that phone call said that Jake Sullivan reiterated the U.S. commitment to democratic principles and the rule of law in Turkey. The Turkish readout, the Turkish version of that phone call, did not mention that at all. It had a whole list of foreign policy and national security related issues between the two countries.
A laundry list.
And Syria, all of these foreign policy issues, but completely omitted the reference to the rule of law and democracy. And that makes me worried, you know, as, you know, particularly, I work for an organization, POMED, which, you know, strongly believes that, you know, democratic principles and human rights issues should be at the center of U.S. foreign policy in general, particularly towards countries like Turkey that have gone through a huge transformation over the last decade. Turkey was never a perfect democracy. I mean, it wasn't even a, you know, fully healthy democracy, I would say, but it always wanted to be a democracy. It always, you know, had that impulse to progress its and strengthen its democratic credentials. But we're seeing the complete opposite under Erdogan. So I think it's very important for the United States to place premium importance on this topic. And that means doing a little bit more. I think it's still early to say, so I do think it's very encouraging, but it takes more than just a one-line statement at the end of a readout of a phone call or a few statements by the State Department. They need to do more. They need to raise these issues with their Turkish counterparts at the highest levels consistently.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how Turkey might react after tonight when Joe Biden issues his first foreign policy address. It's probably unlikely that he's going to name too many countries specifically during it, but there's that expectation that he's going to continue talking about strengthening democracy and speaking up for human rights. And of course, it's a touchy topic for the Turkish government since they released a statement earlier where they did not name the U.S., but they rather passive-aggressively referred to comments from outside observers and then saying, you're no different than us based on events a few weeks ago, which doesn't take a lot of imagination to think about the Capitol riot on January 6th. So do you think that this is almost, would you say that it's accurate to call this almost like a warning shot even to the Biden team that they're not going to be too interested in talking about human rights or democracy promotion in bilateral relations?
Yeah, this, you know, strange moral attempts at moral equivalence has been really the modus operandi of the Turkish government for a number of years now. Every time an outside institution or government criticizes Turkey's failures when it comes to human rights issues and democracy, they lash out and point out the, you know, failings of those own governments to do that, but to do that in their own countries. It's a very, you know, that's become a typical modus operandi of the Turkish government. There is a major problem with this. I mean, today's statement, today the Turkish Foreign Ministry published a statement in which it said, as you know, it didn't directly reference the United States, it strangely referenced some circles abroad who are pushing this message towards Turkey to, you know,
dissent and sending a signal
to criticize behavior. It was the most strange statement that could come out. And I would actually say, you know, when it said we warned these circles abroad from criticizing us before criticizing us, they should look in the mirror. Now, there are two possible things they could be referring to by these circles. It's either the United Nations, which made a statement about this, or it's the Biden administration. And I thought, you know, to me, the reference of, police and protesters clashing here in the United States context was perhaps not what happened around January 6th, but what was happening with the Black Lives Matter protests just last summer, where we did see a heavy police response and security response against protesters. Now, of course, that response came from another strongman leader like President Trump, who has been impeached in this country now twice, and Biden led his entire campaign against this kind of behavior that we saw from Trump. So for Turkey to now say that the Biden administration is one of the representatives of intolerance towards, you know, public expressions of dissent is just a ridiculous response. I think, you know, Turkey is going to continue to publicly reject these kinds of criticisms, but I think it would be a big mistake for the Biden administration to take this at face value and to stop criticizing Turkey for these things and to stop encouraging Turkey to take a more democratic path to change course, because it's otherwise we would just really have a lose-lose situation. And I'm worried that they might end up giving up on Turkey completely, eventually, and not even and to completely stop encouraging Turkey to change its behavior abroad and domestically. I think that would be the worst thing that the U.S. could do to Turkey.
Absolutely, that I think is weighing in the minds of a lot of observers, whether it's in Turkey or the United States, because of course Turkey's made it clear through some of the pro-government columnists, etc., that they do see a way for the U.S. and Turkey to get along, but it has to be almost like modeled on the Turkey-Russia relationship, where it's just pure real politics. There's no comment whatsoever on the internal affairs in one another's country at all. And of course, with the Trump administration, we saw that there was, you know, of course, that understanding, or at least mutual admiration between Erdogan and Trump himself. And the only time, of course, the Trump administration felt it important to act on human rights ground was getting Pastor Andrew Brunson released from Turkey in 2018. But then 2 months later, threatened to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, which, of course, he repeated 1 year later as well. And I think that fear is still in the mind of some people that the Biden administration might engage in some sort of horse trading. Also, do you think that this, of course, promoting democracy and protecting human rights should remain a key priority for the Biden team, even when they try to gain some ground on topics like the S-400 or Syria, for instance?
Yeah, this is a great question. The way this debate is shaping out in Washington right now is that because so many people in Washington, from the left to the right, any ideological camp, are so frustrated with Turkey consistently not acting as an ally, but causing problems for the United States, that now we have basically a consensus among policymakers here in Washington towards Turkey to want and to say that there is no longer a strategic relationship. It would be a mistake to consider Turkey a strategic ally of the U.S. The only way to deal with an actor like Turkey on the international stage is to go completely transactional. So the horse trading you're referring to is the sort of transactionalist approach, where we get what we can get, and then we don't bother with the rest. We don't try to get on the same page with Turkey when it comes to reading the world. We don't try to get on the same page with Turkey when it comes to what is the biggest threat to, you know, our NATO alliance, let's say, you know, forget an alliance of democracies, just NATO alliance, something like that. I do think that's the right course to follow on a lot of foreign policy fronts, because there simply is no other course to follow. I mean, people here are saying that we need to have a more transactionalist approach with Turkey because there's just no other thing has worked. But I fear that this transactionalist approach could cost U.S. advocacy on and promotion of human rights and democratic principles. It would be such a shame if that transactionalism, if that downgrading in relations came at that big cost. Because while, yes, you know, there are many issues, you can try to have a transactional approach and decide not to cooperate with Turkey any further when it comes to Syria, not to cooperate with Turkey over you know, how to push back against Russian expansionism, for example, in the region. You might choose to not play with Turkey on those fronts, given that Turkey doesn't want to play with you. But that shouldn't mean that we have to stop insisting that Turkey adheres to basic principles of human rights around the world. So, you know, let me make this more specific. I worry that if the U.S. stops seeing Turkey as a NATO ally completely and decides to say, okay, we're not going to keep insisting that Turkey behave like a NATO ally, which it is, when it comes to Syria or when it comes to Iran or when it comes to, you know, the Eastern Mediterranean. That's one thing. But to say that, okay, since Turkey doesn't want to be a NATO ally, then we can't really insist on it also acting like a democracy and also respecting things like the rule of law and human rights. That's a big problem. I think, you know, I hope that the United States will do, and the Biden administration will do the opposite of that. And where they try to minimize bilateral problems when it comes to foreign policy on multiple fronts, I hope that they do so while also staying true to the principles of what the United States should do to any country, ally or adversary in this world, which is to try and encourage these leaders to respect fundamental human rights. I do think that that is a major fear that a lot of us have here, looking at the Biden administration view of Turkey as a, it just has to be a transactional relationship, maybe. Fine, you're there, you know, there's no other way to work with Turkey. I get that, but that really shouldn't come at a cost of advocacy for a firm advocacy on human rights and democracy.
And this leads into what'll be my last question, and it's the question ultimately. It's like, what, I mean, you've basically kind of answered this, and I'm going to ask you again. It's like, why ultimately will it be worth it for the United States to continue on this path, especially since last few years, you know, the U.S. is, we haven't particularly gained too much from Turkey concession wise, even while dropping vocalizing about human rights during the Trump administration. And of course, during the Obama years, at least, we had more than one ambassador who was reviled by Erdogan for speaking up, whether it was over Gezi or the post-coup crackdown and everything. And it didn't seem to change anything either. So what is the importance of the U.S. maintaining this position with Turkey? What is the ultimate goal from it?
Yeah, I honestly, so here I want to again decouple two things, which I actually don't think should be decoupled. One is the bilateral issues that stem from foreign policy grievances. Turkey working with Russia as opposed to NATO. Turkey, attacking U.S. partners on the ground in Syria, things like that. Or Turkey pursuing a gunboat diplomacy in the East Med against other NATO allies. These things, I want to separate these for a minute from human rights and democracy promotion. What we saw, because, you know, from a point of view of transactionalism, you could argue that let's not piss off Turkish leaders by raising these concerns about Erdogan's power grabs and Turkey's clear move towards authoritarianism, if, you know, in hopes that we could just save our limited time and opportunities to engage with Turkey, focus those on these other key issues, which are perhaps more important that we get concessions out of Turkey of. This could be one point of view. And I think that this has been the consensus point of view in the US for the last 10 years. Obama officials were quite worried, and I think they diagnosed what kind of a leader Erdogan was, not early on, but certainly throughout the administration. Yeah, they had an understanding of you know, what was happening in Turkey, what kind of a leader Erdogan was, and that it was clear that he was not going to be the quote-unquote Muslim Democrat that he presents himself to be. But they were largely silent on a lot of these power grabs and autocratic moves that Erdogan took. I think in order to be able to preserve a working relationship on these other fronts with foreign policy, that approach failed. The Trump administration did the same thing, saying it took it to another level and said, we are going to stay completely silent, not largely silent, but completely silent on these fronts, on these domestic regression of democracy front, in order to be able to work more closely with Turkey to have a better relationship when it comes to foreign policy fronts. That also failed. So I think what the Biden administration would do is to see that Turkey's foreign policy aggression, it's incredibly, I think there's no other way to put it anymore than disruptive foreign policy moves are an expression of the growing authoritarianism in Turkey, of Erdogan's ability to control, to dismantle democratic institutions, all the institutions that continue to exist in Turkey that would allow Turkey to have a more peaceful foreign policy, more cooperation with its transatlantic allies, control the institutions that make these decisions. I mean, this is the problem. It's precisely Turkey's democratic failure is what's causing Turkey's increasingly brazen defiance of its alliances and institutions that it has committed itself to, like the European Court of Human Rights. This brazen defiance of these institutions like NATO, like the European Court, are just an expression of, are not separate from what's going on inside Turkey with Erdogan's efforts to amass his own powers. What's going with Turkish society, for example, becoming much more anti-American is not separate from Erdogan's full monopolization of Turkey's traditional media outlets and full-fledged anti-American propaganda that we've been seeing over the last few years. These are intimately linked. So I hope that what the Biden administration can do is to prioritize democracy and human rights in Turkey in hopes that that could ultimately help Turkey to cooperate better with the U.S. on these other fronts that we're seeing in foreign policy.
Murph, I'm really happy that you were able to join me today for this. I feel like we still probably have a lot that we could discuss with this. But we can always leave that for another episode of Turkey Abroad down the road if you're interested in returning. So, thank you in the meantime.
Thank you so much. I know we could talk about this till the morning.
there's always something going on with Turkey at the very least.
Exactly. Well, let's hope that what we talked about will be the guidelines of the Biden administration moving forward, and we can see we can talk about more positive things related to this relationship.
And I guess we'll see that from the immediate reactions to his speech at the State Department later on today.
We'll be tuning in.
All right. My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here. For your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.